Last year, disturbing allegations surfaced exposing anti-Indigenous racism in BC's healthcare system. In response, the provincial government conducted an independent review based on input received from Indigenous patients. The findings of the review exposed widespread racism experienced by patients accessing care. Specifically, the report showed negative experiences at the point of care, inequitable medical treatment, physical harm, and tragically, even death. This explicit and frankly heartbreaking acknowledgement of racism in our healthcare system is the first step toward widespread adoption of culturally safe care. But first, we need to define what that really means. In terms of creating a culturally safe healthcare system, what does that actually look like? And what can doctors, healthcare workers, and policymakers do to eliminate racism? In this episode of Doc Talks, a production of Doctors of BC, we'll talk to Indigenous family physician Dr. Terry Aldred and Indigenous cultural safety consultant and coordinator at Fraser Health, Len Pierre, about how we can put culturally safe care into practice. My name is Christine Tam from Doctors of BC, and I'll be hosting this episode of Doc Talks today. I would like to start by acknowledging and thanking the Coast Salish people whose traditional, unceded, and ancestral territory my home and home office resides on. I express my gratitude to the Squamish Nation and Tsleil-Waututh Nation, and I value the opportunity to live and work here on this traditional territory. Len Pierre and Dr. Terry Aldred, thank you so much for joining us today to have this important conversation. Len, in your bio, you're described as a Coast Salish consultant, public speaker, educator, cultural practitioner, and spiritual gangster. Tell us more about yourself and the work that you do.
Sure. Hi, Chika, and thank you very much for having me this beautiful morning. So my name is Len Pierre, and my ancestral name is Palikuluk, and I am Coast Salish from Keetse First Nation. And currently I work full-time for Fraser Health Authority in the position of consultant for Indigenous cultural safety and humility. But I also have my own consulting practice, which is, you know, relatively new and available across the province and Canada for cultural safety and humility and anything kind of decolonial or indigenizing type of work for any kind of systems that we might work with in our country, whether it's, you know, currently, you know, we're talking about healthcare systems. But what we find in healthcare, you know, has a lot of, you know, different kinds of aspects that align in similar issues and challenges in social services system, judicial system, education system. We encounter a lot of, you know, similar types of issues regarding decolonization type of work and indigenizing type of work as well. So that's kind of what brings me to this conversation today. And hi, Chika, thank you for having me.
Great. Thank you so much. It's true. It's not just the healthcare system where this problem exists. So it's really important to acknowledge that. Terry, you have extensive experience treating Indigenous patients in remote communities of BC's North, and you were also the site director with UBC's Indigenous Family Medicine. Tell us about yourself and your work.
Thank you. Well, I have a new ambition after today. It's to become a spiritual gangster. So I'll have to talk to Len about how to get that designation. my name is Terry Aldred, and I'm Decath from Clasden, which is just north of Fort St. James. I'm a member of Lasiliu, the Frog Clan, calling in today from the Tlalit Traditional Territory, otherwise known as Prince George. And I'm a family doctor by trade. I've worked with Carrie County Family Services, serving 12 First Nations communities in North Central BC for the past 7 years. And for the past 5 years, I've been the UBC site director for the Indigenous Family Medicine Program, which has really been the heart and soul of my work for the past 5 years. And recently, in the last 4 months, I became the medical director for primary care for FNHA.
Wow, thank you so much. It's very impressive. Now, I do want to start off with the recent government report, but before we do that, I'd like to ask, how do you personally define culturally safe care and cultural humility? And what does it really mean when we say that? Len, could we start with you?
Sure. So personally, I like to define cultural safety and humility as a practice. It's not perfection. It's a journey, not a destination. And I really think that's an important aspect of cultural safety work, because working in healthcare, we do kind of look at things very objectively. especially when it comes to education and training and learning, is, you know, we do like our tick box moments where we get to tick off something that we have learned and see ourselves as, you know, skillfully competent in this kind of area. But when we take a look at it, just how vast, you know, our unlearning and learning has to be regarding cultural safety and humility, I do like to, you know, define it as more of a journey rather than a destination. And really all that learning is about is addressing our historical traumas, colonial violence that we see and hear about in the development of Canada, ongoing colonial violence that we see. It's really about establishing respectful engagement between people in places of power and privilege. So for us who work in healthcare, carry that power and privilege. And so making sure that our engagements with the people we aim to serve are rooted in respect, reciprocity, and aimed at reducing the amount of power and control that we have in that relationship.
Thank you. Now, Terry, I was wondering if you can speak to what culturally unsafe care looks like, and feel free to add to what Len said, but what might a patient experience when we talk about what is culturally unsafe?
Cultural safety is by definition defined by the people accessing care. And so when somebody feels unsafe when they access care, either because of previous experiences, because of intergenerational trauma, or because there's a reputation. So we've heard that others in our family or our friends may have had unsafe experiences, then that by definition is unsafe. And so in the current system where we don't have good ways of asking and eliciting that feedback from community members or patients on a regular basis, we actually don't know most of the time if our care is culturally safe or not. And instead, we focus a lot of our assessment on asking providers whether or not they feel like the care that they're delivering is culturally safe, which isn't appropriate just by definition. What is appropriate, though, is, as Len was saying, is to engage in a system of regular self-reflection so that we can identify our biases, be critical over our interactions to identify if there's patterns or to identify if there's ways that our biases are impacting the care that we deliver. And so really that's about being self-reflective and being culturally self-aware, both of our own worldview as well as the worldview or understanding of others may have a different worldview, as well as being able to identify and cultivate our skills around cultural humility. So just understanding that the way we see the world and approach things may not be the same as others. And so for me, that's what cultural unsafe care is, essentially when people feel unsafe accessing care for a variety of reasons. And when we start looking at intersectionalities, that becomes even more nuanced around gender, sexual orientation, and things like that. The number of barriers and the amount of fear that people may have accessing care can increase exponentially.
For sure. So that reflecting piece and the listening and understanding piece you mentioned is so important. And moving to the government report, that confirmation and acknowledgement is an important piece that we do need to listen. We do need to understand and learn more. It's, you know, kind of a starting point, but then where do we go from there in terms of affecting actual change? There are more than 20 recommendations in the report. What are the next steps?
The number one thing is, and I think that's why it was very intentional in one of the recommendations, was that the province honor and recognize the reception of the report. And so that's a very macro view. And I think we do need to bring that into a micro perspective too, is that as healthcare providers, we need like unanimous all around validation and recognition that this is an issue. I mean, to move forward with a problem, the first step is recognizing that we have a problem. But I think that the intention that Mary Ellen Terpelafon had with that is that we do have this black and white kind of thinking in society, that we are not racist, that we are non-discriminatory, that we are kind, friendly, and respectful, which is, you know, to some degree true. But this is so deeply rooted in our system, is that we need every single person to show up to work who works in healthcare and all those other systems too, and say, yeah, we do have a problem here and we need to own and honor that. So I would say number one is just saying yes, admitting that we do have a problem. And then really, I would say the second next step on that micro view type of perspective too, is to really own this. So for every single healthcare provider, which is each and every one of us who are listening to this at this very moment, you know, how can I change what I am doing and how can I own this work? Because this is, you know, so deeply rooted, it's in society, it's part of a much bigger context. But we do need to bring that into how can I roll up my sleeves as a healthcare staff person in this province and do some really good work moving forward.
Building off that, what really brings it home are the stories that the report tells, and reading those is so heartbreaking, you know, from a secondhand person reading it and hearing those stories, it's overwhelming and it's sad, let alone what it must be like for patients actually receiving, you know, that type of treatment. It's really hard to read. And Terry, you've worked with Indigenous patients in the north of BC. Do you have any stories like that, or is this something you see on a daily basis, or what has been your experience with those types of stories that are truly heartbreaking?
So certainly, I would say that on a fairly regular basis, I hear from patients who are afraid to go into town to access care, whether or not that may be diagnostics or if I think they need a more urgent or higher level assessment through the ER, or if I think they need to be admitted. I meet a lot of resistance, and a lot of patients want to try to have as much care as they delivered in spaces that they feel safe in, like health centers or in clinics where they have known or there's been that built up of relationship and trust. And so that can be really difficult for me when I'm concerned about a patient and really need either more tests or a consult or to have them go into the ER. And just understanding from my experience, you know, going through med school and my training and have seen and experienced what people do experience on a regular basis in the healthcare system, like I understand, and their fear is founded. I'm in trying to navigate and support them to be able to deliver the best possible care. And so for me, that speaks to what Len was mentioning around it. You know, it takes all of us, right? Like I became a physician because I wanted to give back to my community. I wanted to help address the health disparities I seen growing up. And I very quickly realized that, you know, I cannot do this alone. You know, I cannot protect not even my own family members in all the different settings. And that's when I became really passionate about cultural safety and humility, anti-racism approaches. And because there's so much shame around these conversations, it can be really hard to engage in really courageous, meaningful conversations around this. And I can say that the people, like I know some of the people that my patients have had interactions that they would describe as unsafe, or I know the hospital, and even in the stories shared in the MELT report, you know, the providers that may have been involved in some of those incidences, you know, from their perspective, they may not even have been aware that was the experience the patients were having, because there's such a big disconnect. And until we can help bridge that understanding and come together and be able to have these conversations in a way that kind of helps maintain the respect of all involved, it's going to be really hard to really move this forward. Because once people are in their shame or in their fight and flight, it can be really challenging. And so I feel like from my perspective as a physician, I've seen it kind of from both sides, and people who in healthcare generally want to, like they want to provide a really high level of care. They, you know, in a lot of ways, they feel like they're giving the best that they can, but it's just such a huge blind spot. And that's why that self-reflection piece is so important.
Yeah, thank you. I want to dive deeper into this awareness or unawareness piece that you mentioned. And Len, you touched on it a little bit too. And it makes me think of microaggressions. And, you know, in some settings, this type of racism can be really hard because it, or any racism really can be hard because it's subtle in some cases. And people don't often feel comfortable speaking up. So Len, can you talk a bit about microaggressions and ways in which a speak up culture could help eliminate this type of racism?
Yes, and I think that's such an important question. to kind of always consider in the back of my mind, or our minds, sorry, as a society and as health professionals, is what are microaggressions, right? What do they look like? What do they sound like? And how do each and every one of us play into this type of environment? Because we do see them. We do see them in our workforce. We do see them in our teams. You know, there is a certain social hierarchy that we all play a part in, that we all have an identity that is tied into as Canadian citizens. But there is also, you know, the nature and environment in which we work in healthcare is quite a corporate bureaucratic hierarchy as well. And so that's where I encounter, you know, many different kinds of microaggressions. And that's really, again, going back to power imbalances and people that are unaware of how much power and influence and authority they hold over other people, which is why I think the conversation of cultural humility is so important. So for the social hierarchy, you know, there is a social hierarchy that we all kind of play into. And those microaggressions can kind of play out in subtle language pieces or behavior pieces that treat people differently from us. From one another. So, you know, we are a Canadian society that does like to other people based on cultural differences, whether that's, you know, gender norms or, you know, folks who, you know, have disabilities or folks, you know, people of color, you know, there are subtle microaggressions that do play out in that kind of environment. And because we are, you know, a quote unquote multicultural society, you know, they play out more often than we know and acknowledge. So for example, within in the Indigenous context regarding microaggressions, there are some subtle racist terminology that can come out in that can kind of take the shape of microaggressions. And that's saying things openly, like let's say in the lunchroom or the staff room, like, oh, I'm lowest on the totem pole, or this is my first powwow, or why don't you sit in the chief's chair, which is really, you know, very subtle, very, you know, micro, and they are aggressive because it's othering the Indigenous peoples as something that is not in that physical environment or something in the past. Now, as Indigenous people, you know, not everybody, we don't all look the same. And so there is this, you know, idea that we all know what an Indigenous person looks like and sounds like too. So there are some, you know, folks who are Indigenous and have blonde hair, blue eyes, and very, you know, fair skin, you know, and then so those microaggressions, you know, can be impacting a whole group of people in very hurtful kind of ways. So we also see this play out in the very bureaucratic and corporate nature of our hierarchy as well, where people in places of power, you know, can kind of sometimes place the burden of representation on Indigenous staff and not have that trauma and resiliency informed practice that they apply to their community and workforce. So that's kind of what kind of comes to mind when we're talking about microaggressions and how we just really need to be self-reflective, as Dr. Aldred was saying, and really start to unpack them and acknowledge them, that they exist within us and we exist within that kind of hierarchy in society and in work as well.
Addressing the lack of knowledge part, one of the recommendations in the report is to embed more education about racism, about anti-Indigenous racism, into medical schools. And Terry, as someone who has been through medical school, was this part of the education at all, part of the curriculum? And how do you see this increased education be beneficial?
Before I tackle that, I just wanted to comment on something that Len was saying around microaggressions. I think one of the areas that the MELT report will help with is that one of the things I've seen is that very commonly people in healthcare would take like a colorblind approach, being like, oh, well, like I'm not racist, my department's not racist, or my hospital, or sometimes even the whole healthcare system can't be racist. We treat everybody the same. We're very, very objective. And that kind of often stops the conversation, right? And so it constantly becomes we need to prove. So it's not just enough that a community member said this has happened, it's that we have to prove it. And that could be very exhausting. And so one of the nice things, or one of the hopeful pieces about the report, is to be like, no, like very clearly this is a problem. And also when we look at color blindness, or when we look at that idea that we treat everybody the same, or we don't see color, it actually just kind of perpetuates that idea that other or different is bad. And so really, we should just try to make everybody the same. which is also problematic, because where we want to get at is that, you know, we can celebrate our differences, that you can see my brownness or my indigenousness, my femaleness, and celebrate that and celebrate human diversity, which I will say is a new, a novel way that humanity can evolve to. But I think we're in that place, just like we've evolved in many different ways. I think that we can work at and flex our muscles and be like, you know, we know that, you know, plant diversity is extremely healthy for the planet. Animal diversity is. Human diversity is, and it's been shown that when we have diversity across organizations and countries, like, that's, it helps to drive innovation and a lot of really beautiful things. As far as training, so we had, when I went through medical school, we had 2 half days in our book-based, so the first 2 years preclinical of medical school. So not a lot of formal training in this area. In the clinical years, so years 3 and 4, there was probably even less. And so that's when we first start getting out onto the wards. It's very clinical based. And if you look at studies around empathy, that's also where they start noticing that medical students' empathy starts to decrease. And that's because there's a lot of inherent trauma, for lack of a better word, or adversity that you face. Like, you are on call, so you're staying up all night, you're studying on top of that, you're kind of negating your own human needs, but you're also seeing humans when they're very sick, when people are passing away, and you're having really tough conversations with families. And, you know, it can bring up a lot of your own stuff, but you, there's very little time or capacity to even work through that. And then you layer, you know, hundreds of years of racism and colonialism on top of that. And we know that once you're stressed, your prefrontal cortex, you know, doesn't work as well. And so you're less able to cover up your biases by having this amazing prefrontal cortex to be like, oh, that's not good. You know, suppress that. And so we oftentimes, like, this hidden curriculum, this kind of military, like, in the bunker, you're in survival mode, starts to come out in medicine during those years. And so I think that going forward, it'd be really important to, like, how do we embed cultural safety in clinical teachings, like at the bedside, and make sure that it's incorporated year after year? Because another thing that was shown is that when you have one lecture or one course, or you go to a conference, that it does have usually an immediate impact. But the studies that have followed it, if you don't re-engage and follow up and have a meaningful way to keep reminding yourself of those teachings, you know, and things like Balin groups or reflective practice groups, or even just taking more courses and learning more, that the effect of that does go down. When you look at going into residency, you know, how do we build this into the postgraduate education system in a meaningful way to, again, keep building on those skills? And then again, when we look at continuing medical education, so for, you know, docs out in practice. And then within that, so we'll have hopefully a wraparound a year after year building upon these skills and knowledge needed to become really good, you know, culturally humble and aware practitioners, but also hopefully really effective allies. Because the other thing is that the colonialism and racism is built into the structures themselves. What I've often seen is that my graduates from the Indigenous Family Medicine Program, which can be Indigenous or non-Indigenous doctors, they go across Canada and they work in various settings. And I try to schedule, like, you know, annual alumni calls just to continue that feeling of connection and opportunity to come together in ceremony, and we do a sharing circle. And, you know, one of the things, especially people that are further out, have said is that as time goes on, it's so hard not to fall in line with the status quo, being that constant ally, that constant force within their systems becomes exhausting. You know, it really needs to be this top-down and bottom-up approach, because we need to be able to look at our systems and our organizations and work at it from that level, in addition to building up our healthcare providers. So it can't be an either or, we need a both and.
That's a really good point. And Len, I'm wondering about your work at Fraser Health. When Terry says in terms of not falling in line with the status quo, can you speak a little bit about your work within the health authority to address some of the concerns that Terry just mentioned?
Well, I think, and I completely validate and echo everything that Terry was saying, is like, you know, we cannot look at this as just our staff and our workforce as, you know, the drivers and reinforcers that are leading up to the issues that we're fighting, especially in relation to the report. It's also our systems. Our systems are deeply colonial. And that's, again, back to every single system that we have here in Canada that has their own issues regarding anti-Indigenous racism as well. And, you know, that anti-Indigenous racism was born out of colonial ideology because Canada, you know, needed to minimize Indigenous peoples who are the original inhabitants of Turtle Island to make room for the country, Canada. So that's naturally going to play out into every, and Canada's a colonial system, so that's naturally going to play out into every single system that scaffolds this country. How that would play out into, I would just say, and make it relevant to the work that I do in Fraser Health, is how do we remove away from the othering of people? Because as Indigenous people, you know, we are not the only ones to experience harms in the healthcare system. We are not the only ones to experience racism and discrimination. Rather, how do we make this, you know, about a more inclusive, more holistic, brighter future for every citizen? And so we relate inclusivity, diversity, equity, and cultural safety and decolonial work, you know, that there's benefit for all of us as human beings on Mother Earth. You know, whether you're a woman or a person of color or a person with a disability, a person who has used substances, you know, marginalized and targeted communities, I will say that, targeted communities in Canada, you know, are all at the other end of harms associated with colonial ideology. And so, yeah, it's just how do we break down some of those cultural barriers that often, you know, suppress us? Because quite often too, you know, there are cultural safety education programs and services that continue to reinforce the othering. That's a very bold statement as a cultural safety educator, is that we do have some peoples, you know, that do kind of come into a physical space and make it not such a safe place to learn or engage for everybody necessarily. And there's a whole bunch of reasons behind that, because this is an emotionally charged topic that, you know, when Indigenous people hold space, we do carry, you know, traumas and experiences of racism and discrimination along with, you know, natural human ego into that learning environment too. And sometimes that cannot be the safest space. So we do try to hold some cultural safety principles and philosophy, educational philosophy that is rooted in Indigenous knowledge and values, into that learning space that is warm, it's inviting, it's welcoming. It's a place where you can exercise reciprocity in that learning environment. So you can bring your holistic and full self to this conversation. And that's just kind of the learning environment and the work environment that we do try to honor. Within my own professional practice, you know, when I come into emergency department settings, maternity ward settings, or if I'm speaking to, you know, a group of pediatricians, My first job is to create an environment, a learning environment that is safe, respectful, and reciprocal, and rooted in kindness and togetherness in that learning environment. So folks can ask questions, folks can exercise a healthy amount of guilt, folks can apply what they are learning into their practice immediately in that moment, and then use their voice and their position to inform and collaborate with colleagues and peers in the room at the same time.
I'm wondering if you can elaborate a bit on shifting that view from a binary, I am good, I am bad, I am not racist, to more spectrum-based understanding of how am I racist? How am I biased? I think that's a really important part of the learning. And you mentioned the guilt. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. And that good binary, I think before it comes into a place of outright racism, it starts with our own predetermined judgments, our prejudices. And again, you know, Canada's really good at painting this mural that we're a multicultural, kind, respectful society. And we are taught, you know, whether by our families or by our school system, that to have prejudice is to be bad, and we are not bad people, so don't be prejudiced. What they don't teach us in our society is that, you know, to have prejudice is 100% normal, you know, and that it is 125% impossible to not be without prejudice. Because prejudice is natural, it's human, it's inside every single one of us, because prejudice really is just predetermined thoughts and judgments about other people's cultures. And we're only born into one cultural framework, and that's the framework of our parents and our caregivers. And of course, you know, we go to daycare and elementary school and we're exposed to other people's cultures. But again, it's a very surface level culture. Real cultural awareness comes down to our attitudes and the way we communicate, our approaches to how we go about living life and doing some certain life experiences like marriage or child raising or birthing or authority figures or being together, whatever becomes a social norm under that culture, so to speak. So it's not, again, and just reflecting on what you're saying, Christine, it's not, you know, if I am prejudiced, it's asking ourselves, how are we prejudiced? Because it is impossible to not be prejudiced. And the vast majority of our implicit bias is, I think it's like 95% of all of our biases are implicit, meaning that we're completely unaware of them. And there's a real question. How do we begin to unpack bias if 95% of it we are simply unaware of? So it's really just showing up with that open mind that I do have prejudices, and it's going to manifest into a way that I am going to treat people. So going back to what Terry was saying about we just want to treat everybody the same. No, we don't. We take into people's considerations like their mobility, their gender, their age, and we do take into consideration culture, but implicit. So we need to start just asking serious questions about what people look like, how people sound, all of those things, and start making note of them and start having conversations about them openly with our teams and with our colleagues. And I say that because we're trained, and this is part of the problem too, we're trained. We all come from a training system, and that's true to anybody who's gone to post-secondary for their work. We're trained to have a very high cognitive resiliency, because we have to defend our arguments, we have to come up with arguments, we have to be graded on those arguments, and then if we fail, we have to bounce back really quick to pass. And then we are absorbed into this corporate system where we constantly need to argue and defend and exercise that. What society is not really good at teaching or training us in is having an emotional and social resiliency to be able to have complicated and complex conversations like race and racism. And if you don't think that, you know, talking about race and racism is complicated and complex, just bring it up at the next family dinner conversation and watch how many emotions start to kind of go up when it's like, what do you mean we want to talk about racism? There's no racism here, right? But those are the kind of the conversations that we need to have so that we start to build up our resiliency to be able to have it. Because one of the barriers that will manifest if we don't talk about it is that people will constantly default into removing race and racism from the table for conversation, like Dr. Aldred was saying. It's like, no, we're multicultural. No, we're equal. We treat everybody the same. Coming back to that color blindness. I don't see color. I don't see culture. But to me, the way I prescribe it, so to speak, would be just to start having those conversations. If it's not safe or you don't feel safe having them in your teen environment yet, bring them home, start them with your partner, start them with your children, and start talking about racism, equity, diversity. Have them with your children. I know that our children going through the education system today are building up their emotional and social resiliency because social emotional learning is a part of the curriculum transformation that we've seen in this province. And because we recognize that that was a need. And so they're coming, you know, well-equipped for these kinds of conversations.
That's such a good point, Len. And I think having those uncomfortable conversations takes so much courage because often when one wants to call out racism, the response can be very defensive and sometimes very unsafe. So what can people do in that moment where they might want to call someone out or call out a situation without putting themselves in harm's way?
One of the most common questions I get asked, and I'm sure Len gets asked, is, can I call out racism, or how can I address it in the moment when I see it in the wards or wherever I am? And that's a very good question to have. Like, how do you start these conversations? How do you build up the safety to be able to have those conversations and the accountability so you can be held accountable in a safe way? And so it is a good conversation to have. I think the other part of that people don't talk about is, how can I receive feedback around something I did that may have been biased or may have been racist or sexist? Because again, it comes back to that undertone to say, I'm not racist. So clearly I'm going to be able to call it out in other people, but nobody's ever going to call it out in me. And it becomes that us and them. Whereas if we come back to what we have mentioned around, like, this isn't all of us. Like, we inherited a racist, sexist culture that, you know, in the Canadian context, privileges certain bodies over others. then, you know, we have to understand that if we want to build this healthcare system where we can have these courageous conversations, we also need to be able to build that shame resilience, where we can sit in the extreme discomfort of somebody being like, I think that was a little biased, or this is what I seen. I don't know if that was safe for that person that you were seeing. It's very uncomfortable. And we need to also build up our skills to be able to do that. It's great to talk about how we will call in our colleagues or call out our colleagues if we're seeing harm, but we also have to build up our own resilience around being called out in this space or called in. And I find that as people do this work and they start seeing themselves more and more as allies, sometimes that does translate into a decrease in humility. So they actually find it harder to receive feedback because they're like, but I've done all this work, I've taken all the courses, I spend, you know, 3 months a year in community, like whatever it is. But sometimes people start to lose some of that humility the more that they're called in and the more that they know. And so just to understand that this, as Len said at the beginning, that this is an ongoing journey and really does require very regular practice. Like even from an Indigenous context, like I have internalized racism and sexism and things like that just from our culture. Like it's in, you know, the media we see, it's in the people we see on TV. It's impossible to not have been socialized around these concepts. And so just kind of understanding that, you know, as Len was saying, it is human and we do need to be very intentional on how we, like on our thoughts and our behaviors and on a regular basis.
And it's not just patients who are experiencing racism too. So one of the recommendations in the report is to have more Indigenous healthcare workers, doctors, nurses working in healthcare at all levels. But those workers are not immune to racism themselves. So Terry, what are some challenges with implementation that you might see?
I think everybody's journey into healthcare careers and going through training is a little bit different. And certainly there's people who have had really good experiences. And I know that for others and potentially many, it comes with a lot of additional re-traumatization and a lot of additional burdens for a variety of reasons. And so I agree that I think we can't really truly say that we are diverse or equitable until we see that kind of representation at every level, from policymakers right down to the frontline workers. We need to be able to see ourselves and representation throughout. And so it is very important to look at how we make space for diverse voices and be able to recruit in and retain people from diverse backgrounds. However, I think oftentimes the effort is focused on just getting people in the door, you know, like let's increase our admissions, let's hire more Indigenous people or whatever the mandate would be to kind of fulfill that diversity quotient. And a lot less is done to say, okay, and how can we ensure that it's a good experience once they're through the door, that they are supported in a way that feels good to them? What additional things might they need that may not be true for other students or other professionals, and really being mindful of that, because as I said, people get exhausted when they're the only one or when they're one of very few, and really needing that connection with people who are like them. So I found that, like, you know, having sharing circles with other Indigenous physicians is really powerful, because it's not too often that in my just general working life that I get to work with a lot of other Indigenous physicians. So they have my, like, a shared history, but they also have my shared training, and that can be really powerful. And the residents, as they move out of the Indigenous Family Medicine Program, often say that that's what they miss the most, is just that community of like-minded residents. And that's just one example, but I think we have to be cognizant that, yes, we want to get people through the door. That's really important. But how can we support them in a good way once they are there? And that goes all the way to, like, offboarding. How can we ensure that people's integrity and respect is intact when they're offboarded, so that they, if they're moving on to other opportunities or what have you, that they're still inclined to tell their friends, family, community members that, hey, that's a really great place to work. And so I think when we start thinking through the whole continuum, the whole life cycle and throughout the organization, we can still probably do a better job of getting people through the door. But I find, especially once they're in, to say, hey, how can we really support these individuals in a good way?
It really comes down to what you both have said about this being a journey, not a sprint, and there are no overnight solutions to this type of systemic problem. But what are some things that doctors listening can do right away to start or continue this work?
Sure, definitely. I think that there's always room and capacity for us as health professionals to be able to continuously learn. And I think that we naturally do that in any healthcare practice or professional domain, is we're always learning. And part of that learning is to evolve within our roles. And, you know, this is a good time as any to continue our learning about the lands on which we work. And so I always say that is step one, is to people who are always like, there's so much to learn, Len, where can I start learning? And I say, always bring it back to the land in which you are working and living. So whose local nations are you providing care and services on? And that's the greatest place to start. And then, you know, should you find out the courage and the willingness to continue your learning? Because, you know, even myself as an Indigenous person who teaches, is always in a state of constant learning about Indigenous cultures. And not just about, and this is what I would encourage folks to think about too in their learning, is that it's not just the surface level above the water, the easy stuff to learn. It's getting down to the deeper cultural aspects, like our attitudes about death and dying, our approaches to child raising, to communication, work ethics, those types of things. Because quite often that's where we find that there is misunderstanding and where some harms can happen within cultural safety, is that we just don't have that cultural awareness on how different cultures go about doing different things and what safety might look like in that regard too. So number one, I always say ongoing learning, and then also kind of taking a critical look at reflecting on professional practices and what you might have learned through your post-secondary training, through your secondary public school training, and finding some areas where you might need to unlearn what you have learned. And you know what, for that matter, because of Canadian socialization and the extreme amounts of prejudice and discrimination that are out there against Indigenous peoples in this country, sometimes the things that we need to unlearn have come from our parents. And come from the houses that we've grown up in, because it's a part of Canadian socialization that has contributed to the massive anti-Indigenous racism that we see from coast to coast to coast. And a lot of that does, I'm going to say it, comes from the own houses in which we were raised. And so it's not just learning, it's also unpacking what are some of those blind spots that you need to honor and recognize? And then what are some of the things that you've been carrying for a long time that you just need to unlearn?
I would agree. Like in healthcare, we're not as skilled in being able to feel comfortable in paradox. And what I mean by that is that, again, to bring it to the household, your parents are good people that had their own prejudice. And I think that, again, we like to really rapidly make assumptions about some of our thoughts or feelings that come up. And part of that is, this is true. So if I'm racist, or if my uncle's racist, they must be a bad person, or I must be a bad person. And I don't think I'm a bad person, so therefore I must not be racist. And it just kind of happens very quickly. When really, like, all truth usually has some paradox in it. And so there's a nuance. And so we can, when we do have prejudice, and we can be good people. And so a lot of people talk about the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And oftentimes people will then be like, oh, well, then, you know, like having good intentions isn't good. I'm like, well, it's good to have good intentions. The part is that you need to measure your impact. And so you need to start somewhere. And you may not know where to start, and you may not get it right off the bat, but it's good to start. Just be open and ask for feedback on the impact that has. It's really important to see people in diversity. So if you're only ever seeing Indigenous people in the emergency rooms or in your clinics, then that's going to shape a very particular set of thoughts or beliefs. So it's important to try to see people in their diversity. So seeing people at cultural events like National Aboriginal Day, if there's public community offerings, try to go out to the community, introduce yourself to the healthcare staff. Try to diversify yourself in many different ways, not just with Indigenous people, but with people of color, with people from different orientations and religious beliefs, because all of that helps to address prejudice without you even trying, other than trying to form those connections. But it helps, because when you start to see people in their diversity, when you start to see a diverse range of people from, you know, similar backgrounds, you understand that there's a lot more difference and variance within groups than there are necessarily between groups. And that helps you to start questioning some of your inherent prejudice and makes you a little bit more curious. And that just comes down to like the continuing learning. It may not be with people that you can do this all the time, especially in the time of COVID. So it may be looking at, what are the movies you're watching? What are the shows you're watching? Who's producing them? Who's starring in them? What books am I reading? What are those authors? What kind of artists do I like? Maybe I can broaden that a little bit. And so there's lots of different ways, but it's just one simple step that people can start taking to help raise awareness around different people and their cultures and worldviews.
Thanks, Terry. Those are great suggestions. And in terms of measuring success and knowing that we are successful or have been successful, what are some key things to keep in mind?
I think it's really important for us to be able to look at metrics around this. And so around like how do we evaluate our progress over a period of time? Like, are we going to do a MELT report every 5 years? Are we going to what are we going to do to help see if we're moving the needle? Because what I have seen is that there's some ideas around how to address this. And, you know, we've developed programs and we have Indigenous health programs as part of many health organizations and different things. And so we've already started doing some of the work. And so how can we effectively show and demonstrate that we're moving towards metrics that we care about? And so is that looking at the health disparity gap and seeing if it's closing? Are we going to start collecting patient data regularly around them rating their care and how culturally safe it is? Like, I think that that kind of conversation is also going to be really important, because what I've seen is that a lot of this data, because racism isn't sexy, people don't like to put research dollars into it. And so there hasn't been really great data or really well thought out ways to assess this on an ongoing regular basis. So it is a journey. So we can't just say, you know, we're going to get to a point, it's going to be done. So we need a long-term solution for how we're going to continually measure progress or lack of progress, because if we don't see progress, then that should inspire further action and deeper commitments down the road.
Thank you, Terry. And Len, what are some resources that you recommend?
The first one is cultural safety training, and that there are, you know, now low barrier accessible forms of cultural safety training. So the provincial SANUS training I know is a big one. It's 8 to 12 hours online, and it is now free, and it is accredited. So physicians who take it, you know, do get credits in that regard. And then check in to see if your local health authority has regional specific cultural safety training courses, and bring it on and making it an initiative, making it a thing for your division, for your practice. Also, you know, how do we start to unpack that implicit bias piece? You know, there are implicit bias association testing online platforms that you can utilize. Universities who are invested in this kind of research do have implicit association testing that's available just by a Google search. And then for, you know, anybody who's in a position of leadership or influence over how the organization runs, really adopting some sustainable measures to invest in responding to anti-Indigenous racism in their kind of respective domain. So that looks like zero tolerance policies and really formulating what I call Indigenous focused health equity strategies. And that's just recognizing that we can't brush cultural safety under the same umbrella of diversity and equity. And I say that because diversity and equity have been around for a long time. And I'm very curious as to how, you know, diversity and equity have really helped Indigenous peoples under those kinds of specific strategies. So really investing in Indigenous focused health equity strategies, I think, will go a long way. So then it becomes a long-term embedded policy within programs and organizations, so that the organization really is taking ownership over this good work moving forward, which I think will have, you know, your biggest bang for your buck, so to speak.
Those are some excellent tips and great places to start. I want to thank you both, Dr. Terry Aldred and Len Pierre, for joining us today on Doc Talks. I really appreciate hearing your perspectives and thoughts on this issue. You can find a list of resources discussed on this episode on the Doc Talks webpage and in the show notes for this episode. Doc Talks is a production of Doctors of BC, and you can visit us online at doctorsofbc.ca and on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.